Usually Sunday I would be talking about the far-going meditation, Dhyana Paramita, but we're doing a refuge ceremony this Sunday the 15th, right? So Elizabeth and Donna will be here if the causes and conditions are auspicious. But I wanted to talk a little bit about refuge and how that relates to meditation, to Dhyana Paramita. People want to do a formal yoga and meditation practice, but without taking refuge, notice that there's not much result. So when we say taking refuge, two things are happening. We're renouncing. I like that kind of word because it sounds so powerful, because it is. We're renouncing samsara, and we're taking refuge in the Lama, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So we're leaving a scary situation, a panic situation, to go to a safe situation, to start doing real stability meditation or shamatha, let alone insight or vipassana meditation. We need to have renunciation. If we're just using it to entertain ourselves or become more powerful, then we won't accomplish the correct results. Most importantly, unless there's a real feeling of safety and a real feeling of belonging, we're not going to be able to settle down enough. We'll be sitting on our cushion, but our mind will still be spinning. I'm very close to finishing up my meditation booklet, which has now become a mini book, because I didn't want to just put out another short meditation manual that didn't talk about the need for establishing refuge, for leaving our destructive habits and misguided perceptions and going in the right direction towards safety and healing. So when the book comes out, you'll see I'm devoting some time to talking about the necessity for refuge and the necessity to do what we call Lojong. Lojong means mind training. The mind training we're talking about is reflecting on the truths of existence so that we maintain our dedication and we maintain our motivation to practice. Over the years, I'm hoping people are getting tired of me saying the reason people stop practicing is because they're not reflecting on four thoughts that turn the mind to Dharma. Briefly, the four thoughts or four contemplations are the precious human birth we've taken, along with the auspicious abilities to do the practice and hear the Dharma, have authentic teachers, teachings, and so forth. When we reflect on how difficult it is to get a human rebirth, many people in the West are really surprised, because we think, oh, I want to be a bird next lifetime. I want to be my cat or something. That may happen, so you'll get it. But in the Dharma situation, actually, even though at this point, what, I don't know, 8 billion people on the planet or something? Yeah, that's actually a small percentage when we compare, from Buddhist point of view, the number of beings in our whole world system, which is basically the universe. So just taking rebirth as a human is not a curse or punishment, but an extreme opportunity. And then when we all have the fortunate conditions to have our health, intact body, to have a mind that can understand Dharma, to have a place where we can practice on authentic teachings. We see how actually rare it is to be able to come in contact with authentic Dharma and a deep sense of appreciation along with a deep aspiration not to waste a precious human rebirth is born. The second is impermanence. So usually impermanence is as seen as kind of negative and like things are passing away. And in this case, we're dwelling on the fact that things pass away. We don't know our time of death. And we don't know how we're going to die. So it isn't just that we're getting older or things are changing, but that the shortness or length of our life is unknown. So there's no time not to practice. I've worked with death and dying people in family and through Dharma Center. And I sometimes tell the story of a close student, Mary, who said to me as her last words, "I wish I had practiced more." This is, you know, people don't say trivial things when they're dying, generally. So I know that was the real truth. It's interesting how when people do get terminal disease, then their practice really kicks in, right? Well, now, well, we all have terminal disease, okay? So this is the correct view to when we're contemplating impermanence. We're not just talking about, you know, things changing or losing something. We're talking about the fact that we don't know exactly how long our life is going to be. The third thought is the world of karma. This is a difficult one because we have a strong delusion. The delusion is we won't experience the consequences of our actions. Really strong delusion. So we have another strong delusion that if we become Buddha, we won't experience the consequences of our actions. One of the books on the reading list that we've had on and off and added again is Old Path, White Clouds, Thich Nhat Hanh's biography of the Buddha. And it's even shortened. The book's nice and thick. He's left certain things out, but a few things he left in is several attempts on the Buddha's life. And countless arguments among the Sangha, right? And several accusations of all kinds of scandal and so forth. This is all because of the Buddha's karma, right? Some was past life, some was immediate. If you decide to teach and form a Sangha, you will get some karma like this, right? That will happen, okay? So there are always going to be some consequences. It's how we handle the consequences that really makes the difference. But there are always karmic consequences. You will not get enlightened and escape karmic consequences. You may not create, and hopefully you wouldn't create as a high-level bodhisattva or Buddha, more negative consequences, but you will create them. One of the head high lamas in Tibetan Vajrayana Buddhism is the Karmapa. Action person, pa means like person, just called the Karmapa, you know, action person. So, of course, we want to create beneficial karma, you know, as bodhisattvas. But even if we just create realization now, we're still going to have the karma, right? At least Buddha had the karma that he died, right? So we're not going to escape that. I had some friends back in the 80s that demonstrate some magical thinking. It's kind of sad, but, you know, some of my friends did become HIV positive and had AIDS, and they felt that if they did a lot of Dharma practice, they could escape that. But they didn't. The real karma we escape is creating the negativity about what happens. But each of us is going to have pretty much the same karma, actually. Right? So we really reflect that we're not going to get away with anything. So this deeply might has to come in. And then the fourth thought that turns the mind is suffering. The omnipresence of samsara. These are meant to be a little bit downer, okay? So, but because we want to create that kind of push away from samsara, even though we're doing Dharma practice, the tendency when things are going well is to kind of imagine that that will last forever. Or we'll imagine that we'll get to some kind of changeless realm where there won't be any problems. As long as we are still under delusion, as long as we are still creating negative karma, there's going to be samsara left over. When I go on vacation, like particularly when I go somewhere nice like Santa Fe, for a few minutes I feel like I'm in a heaven realm, right? Everyone's good looking, has money, the food tastes great, the air is clean, you know? So it's really easy to think, oh, this will last forever. But there's still samsara. Of course, sitting here, it's really easy to go, well, I'm not going to do that. But it's really easy to do that. When our health is good, we never think we're going to get sick, right? We feel completely, solid. So contemplating the four thoughts is not meant to be depressing, but it's meant to be energizing so that we really recognize the need to practice. I should mention, contemplating karma too means we're contemplating our life, we're going over our life and thinking, okay, this has been my life history. These have been the pains, these have been the abuses, this has been the abandonment, this has been the betrayals. Not to, depress ourselves, but to really be very clear about what we've been through and what we probably go through. People sometimes ask me for divinations, sometimes I give them divinations that say, well, some bad stuff's going to happen. And then they go, well, what practices can I do to avoid it? And I say, you can't do any practice to avoid this one. You have to do practice to be present with it. And then people's face kind of goes down. I'm happy to do some divinations for people, but I'm the kind of lama that will also give you bad news. Do you want that? People don't like it when you pay for it. They want it. But wait a minute. I paid for it, Okay. So, based on the four thoughts that turn the mind, we develop a strong renunciation and a strong aspiration to be somewhere where there's safety and there's healing. So those two things have to be very strongly present, and we have to develop that safety, and we have to do healing meditations. Most people that come to me and want to learn shamatha practice, vipassana, are not even ready to sit because they're still in trauma or panic. They need to find a safe place to land. They need to find a safe community, a safe teacher, and it can take some folks, years to check out, right? I like it when some people are actually safe, safety-oriented in a direct way. They say, well, how do I know I can trust you? It's a good question to ask, right? So when checking out teachers in situations, don't be passive aggressive. Don't be coy. Just say, you know, what evidence to have that I can be safe here, that I can learn something. So hopefully the people taking refuge in the past, as well as this Sunday, will have thought, okay, I really want to leave samsara, and I want to come to someplace safe and have checked me out and checked you guys out, and they're ready to leave, and it feels safe. After a safety is established, then there has to be some healing. It's very difficult to do formal meditation practice when people are in, you know, extreme emotional pain. We like to think, oh, I'll just do the practice and the pain will go away, or I'll do the practice and I won't have to deal, you know, with my childhood sexual abuse or something. It doesn't work. I wish it worked, but it doesn't work. That's what we call actually spiritual override or spiritual materialism. I think, well, okay, I'll start practicing and then I won't have to deal with all this shit because I'll see the emptiness of it all, or realize nature mind, and then the rest of the stuff won't make any difference. While reflecting back, we're not going to escape the consequences of our karma. So if there's emotional stuff that comes with it, there's no just pressing zero button. We're willing to deal with it. So the healing aspect that we talk about, and we do a lot of Medicine Buddha practice, is the willingness to unpack our world, our history, our karma, and meet it with awareness and love. It's kind of a duh, right? But I've found that people that skip that step, developmental step actually, really have a difficult time settling into the demanding concentration practices of shamatha, let alone the fundamental practices of vipassana and mahavipassana, let alone deity yoga or mahamudra or dzogchen. You're just not going to be settled down because the stuff's still happening. So, you know, I was talking to Susan the other day, and I said, you know, we really have to emphasize Lojong practice, because Lojong, or mind training, when we say mind training, it doesn't just mean like symbolic logic. It means we're training ourselves to be present with all the history of our experience, and we're training in to be doing practical follow-up on our experience. So if people say to me, well, I'm just going to train to be more mindful, I always want to follow up with saying, being mindful of what? You know, like, are you going to mindfully get in your car and leave? You know, what are you going to do mindfully after this? So Lojong is always very practical and very specific. So we never leave Lojong practice. It's not like, well, I did Lojong and now I'm doing, I'm not doing Lojong anymore. I'm doing Mahamudra or something, you know, silly. So working with all the details of our experience and our personal history, and working with the 1,000-1,500 years of Lojong from Tibet, people have found that it brings people into that place of healing. I know people in this room could personally testify to that. So when we're getting ready to do formal meditation, we've taken refuge, we've gone to a safe place, we've started to do the healing practice, and then the next thing is we actually generate some interest in others and some compassion. So that's called the Bodhisattva path, awakened being path. This year I'd like to do, in addition to refuge, introduce, which I've done way long ago, is introduce Bodhisattva vows. The Bodhisattva vow ceremony is very old, and although it's we talk about Bodhisattva practice in a little small way in the refuge ceremony this Sunday, the Bodhisattva vows go into much more detail and spell it out. Because if you take refuge here at Lion's Roar, at some point, we're going to ask you to do something. And for some people, it's kind of like, well, wait a minute, I just come here to meditate, and now you're asking me to do something? So it's important to emphasize the Bodhisattva vows, which means we're willing to work with other people's craziness, let alone our own. We're willing to be inconvenienced by other people. We may even be willing to be misunderstood by other people. We may even be willing to have our feelings hurt by other people and still be willing to be helpful and keep our heart open. We'd be willing to think that person's an asshole, but I want them to be free and happy, okay? So it entails that ability to keep our heart open and the willingness to take on some responsibility. So generally, in Asia, Bodhisattva practice is generating what's called bodhicitta, which is called the thought or the spirit of awakening. And generally, people reflect reflect on their mothers and parents, but mothers particularly. Actually, I like that because even though in the West we have this mother complex going on, I think it's good to reflect on the fact that at least even if our mothers weren't perfect, which they weren't, we reflect that we the product, us, has come intact and that we can practice Dharma, so we're extremely grateful. And then the next piece in Bodhisattva practice is that we take some responsibility for the world. So generally the metaphor has been we see all beings or other people in some sense as our children. Now once again in the West we think, well, that's codependent or stupid, but in Asia it's just meaning just like we take responsibility for teaching our kids good values and feeding them and seeing them grow up, we take responsibility, you know, for others. Not doing their work for them, not doing stuff that they should be doing, not taking on stuff that we shouldn't be taking on, but having a sense of universal responsibility, as the Dalai Lama said. So I'm responsible for you all, and you're responsible for me. And once again, responsible doesn't mean that you can become enlightened for me or I can do it for you. But we're willing to extend ourselves so that other people's interests in suffering and awakening are part of our mandala. We want to see other people succeed. So we're doing a lot of this in just the short prayers we're doing, right? We're not doing four thoughts that turn the mind, and I thought of adding that. Yeah, I know, in our little prayer book, and because I love it so much. But in the booklet on meditation, I'm going to try to present the refuge and the safety and healing and the Bodhisattva practices in a way that people can understand it, even from a non-religious point of view. So that when people sit down to do a meditation and they find out their crazy monkey mind won't stop, they don't give up. Or when you sit down for even a short meditation of watching your breath and images come up from past traumas or angers toward people come up, you won't stop. Or when you're sitting just in basic meditation and angels come and tell you they're enlightened and you can quit meditating, you won't quit meditating. Because it's ironic, but a lot of times when people have positive experiences, they stop, right? Anybody ever heard of anybody like that? Like, they go, well, I'm done. I'm enlightened. So I've had those conversations. Of course, I've been doing this a long time. Like, okay. If we can have that basic booklet out, I promise I will finish it. But it's going to be like a little mini book now, right? Also, the last piece, and we'll take a break in a moment, is in conventional spirituality, and particularly in Buddhism, there's the wrong idea that we should become mind only and leave behind the body, so that spiritual practice becomes a long, painful process of disassociation. You find this in other religious traditions too. We want to kind of mortify the body, or we think the whole plan is just to be unattached and be spiritual and not be involved in mundane things. Actually, the Dharma teachings are completely the opposite. We have to become deeply connected, even, I could use the word incarnated, but with wisdom. So the way out is further in, but with a wisdom mind. That's really difficult, because also many of the traditional texts make it sound that way. Certainly when we read the Heart Sutra, you might be thinking, well, the aim is to be floating in space somewhere, right? It doesn't say anything about, you know, going to Costco this weekend or, you know. So these profound texts that are talking from the aspect of ultimate truth have to be interpreted. So we do need a teacher. We do need a tradition, because the tendency in formal Dharma practice is to think, well, I should be floating about 2 inches off the ground. I should never get angry. I shouldn't have any thoughts. I shouldn't have another piece of chocolate cake. You know, just completely idealistic and impossible practice. The point of practice is to be fully embodied and present. So that's why I'm calling the book Loving Embodied Presence. There's a tendency when reading high-level things to think that there are no emotions present. Has anybody ever had that idea? Like, the whole idea is, you know, if I just don't feel anything, I'll be fine. You know, it's like, well, that it's to have a full range of feelings, but feelings that are completely embedded in wisdom, and it's possible. So in Vajrayana, we really do, when we do a full practice, we really do want our cake and eat it too. We really want to have a completely full life. So that's my goal here, Lion's Roar. We're doing a temple. Eventually, I hope we do a retreat center in a monastery. But a temple means we're all participating actively in the community and daily life. So I want you more incarnated and more here. That's easy, right? You just show up and it'll happen. Okay, so maybe we can take a short break and then 10 minutes. Have one or two profound questions. So think them through, and then we'll do some sitting meditation. How's that sound? Capisce? Huh? Okay, all right, thank you.